when in the 80s were bad, we used to get prank phone calls all the time.
Did you really?
Saying, I shot JR, and they would hang up.
And did you ever get any about Patrick Ewing as well?
Well, you know, I went to Georgetown, and he's a Georgetown grad,
so yeah.
But we're clearly no relation.
Clearly.
But my mother used to get, my mother's name was Mary Sue, so it was very close to Sue Ellen. So we got more JR jokes than Patrick Ewing jokes.
There you go. We have Heidi Ewing on the show, not to harass her about her name, but because she was the co-director of an amazing film. I'm telling you, folks, for me, I watched the entire thing. It's amazing, inspiring, and I hope a wake-up call for parents and educators around the country. It has won pretty much everywhere it's been as best documentary. And I actually enjoyed not only the film. I watched the entire film with my 12-year-old and my 15-year-old. But I also watched the stuff afterwards, including the conversation with Bill Cosby, the deleted scenes, the boys' update. Everything in this thing is a fascinating film. Tell me a little bit about how it started. How did this whole project get underway?
Well, documentary filmmakers are always looking for new ideas and listening to other people's conversations and reading periodicals and snooping around and just sort of always on the lookout for what would be a story that could be told well visually in the documentary form. And about 6 years ago, I was reading a back issue of Newsweek magazine that was sitting in a production office where I was working, and I was sort of flipping through the magazine, and I saw this sidebar article about this experimental boarding school called the Baraka School that purported to take inner-city kids from Baltimore, 10,000 miles away, to the East African bush to give them an education. And I thought that was a wild and possibly harebrained idea, but something of interest. And I thought, is it really that bad that we have to send our own kids to Africa for an education? So I was, you know, I pulled the article, and then Rachel and I, my business partner and co-director, we started our company a year later, and I kept the clipping, and we got in touch with the school, and it took us about a year to convince them to let us make the film. And once we convinced them, we started on this four-year journey, which resulted in The Boys of Baraka.
Yeah, I won't give away too much of what happened on the film, but first of all, the fact that the program still deceased at this point?
That is correct.
What a tragedy that is, and even more of a tragedy that someone locally in this country hasn't put up some kind of a program like this for us, the same kind of youth.
Well, we're putting a call out to Oprah Winfrey. She should reopen the school. That's what we're hoping.
That would be good.
That's just a fantasy.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do have hopes that the school will be reopened by someone who sees this film, because it was working, and there was a lot of value to it. It wasn't the African component at all. It was really the fact that these 12-year-old boys were allowed to breathe and become children and to have a regular learning environment and three square meals a day and teachers who focused on them. And they were sort of out of the belly of the beast that is the Baltimore public school systems, on top of which the kids in our movie live in very dicey ghettos that are very impoverished and drug-ridden. And there's a certain stress that comes along with that, it prevents kids from really being able to learn. And I think all those things just sort of, you know, evaporated at the Baraka School, and they were able to actually look at themselves differently and think about, you know, a long-term life and life beyond the age 25 or whatever. So, you know, just removing the kids from the environment was the important thing, not necessarily going to Africa.
I agree about that. And it's interesting to note that my son, who was sitting next to me and is almost 15 years old, watching the movie, toward the end of the movie, said to me, "Hey, Dad, why are these kids just sitting on their steps? Why aren't they doing anything?"
Mm.
I had to explain to him that they were limited in what they can do. And in fact, when the camera then came into the window and looked out on a drug deal through the window, mm-hmm. he understood a little bit about what was going on outside that building, that people couldn't be running around without getting hurt. And of course, the same thing happens here in Boston and many other major cities in this country, where there are certain schools or certain neighborhoods that nobody wants to go in because there is really no life going on there. It's people pretty much in a zombies-like state. They're not learning anything. They're not doing anything. They're just kind of sitting there.
It's an epidemic, you know. I mean, it really is. We always do. I live in New York City, and everyone's always talking about, you know, how much more livable New York City is than it was, you know, 10 years ago, and how it's cleaned up, and it's a wonderful place to live, which is true. But, you know, it's like every other major city. You go to the outer boroughs, and you go to certain parts of Manhattan, and, you know, there's people on the stoop, and there's people who are unemployed, and were public schools that are overrun, and it's just in our inner cities, really. You know, there's definitely the virus, you know, continues, and I think it's something that we need to look at again, especially when it comes to the schools. You know, there is no excuse for a subpar public school, zero. In the richest country in the world, none. I can't think of one reason why that the education provided by, you know, the government could be so, you know, despicable. And that's what I saw in Baltimore. And it just seems like it doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't seem productive, and it seems that it doesn't help our country in general, you know, to sort of just have throwaway lives and a whole population of kids that's just kind of discarded. It doesn't make sense to me on a social level, or even, you know, on an economic level, to let this go on. So it's mind-boggling to me. It really is.
I don't think we can just blame the schools. I think that Bill Cosby said it well at the end of the film there, and that the piece he does, A Conversation with Bill Cosby. He really talks about parental involvement too.
Absolutely.
And he also mentions putting a body on somebody.
Yep.
Because and he's exactly right.
Yep. I agree. I agree with him. And I totally agree with you. It's not just the schools. Absolutely. I mean, it's soup to nuts. You know, the upbringing of a lot of these kids is just without any guardianship, without any role models, and oftentimes, most of the time, there's definitely no dad around. I mean, none of the kids in our movie had any, you know, biological father living remotely nearby. It's definitely a combination of parental involvement and the schools and the situation. I mean, it's definitely a holistic problem, you know.
Right. And the interesting thing is that once you get to know these kids by name, by who they are, and then you follow them and you check in the extras where it actually gives you an update on these kids, and I'd like to even get more of an update from you. But one of those kids is one of the top math students in the state, and many of them have gone on, and it's not just because, you know, they learned over in Africa, but many of them had that intrinsically in them, and no one had ever brought it out because it took that act of bravery on their part and on their family's part to let them go over there and kind of, you know, develop their own confidence in themselves and the different
Absolutely.
Areas.
I mean, their whole vision of themselves is what changed. I mean, if you grow up and you don't know anyone who's ever gone to college, in fact, you don't know anyone who's graduated high school, if you don't know any male, and you're an African-American, you know, 12 or 13-year-old in Baltimore, if you don't even know anybody who's gone on to, you know, gainful employment or an education, if you don't even, how are you supposed to think that you're going to be the first one? I mean, that's tough. That's mm-hmm. definitely a leap, you know. Mm. It's a big leap for anyone to make. Anyway, and I think it did take these kids, you know, needed to sort of reevaluate themselves and look at themselves with a different eye and say, oh, yeah, it's definitely going to be me. I'm definitely going to be the first. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's the burden that's on my shoulders. And to acknowledge that and to embrace that, being the first, that's what kind of happened to a lot of these kids. You know, sort of talk about going to college with ease as if it's definitely going to happen, you know, as opposed to before they went to the school. And they wouldn't even utter those words for fear of being ridiculed or, you know, that they're even their mom or their aunt or someone would say, oh, come on now, you know, let's not get ahead of ourselves. So I think they definitely started to see themselves differently. And we watched it happen, and we could see it unfold. And we were actually able to capture that, I hope, on camera, that sort of those inner workings of their brain as they decide not to act up or they start giving advice to their friends. And it just was an incredible, stunning thing to watch as a filmmaker and as a storyteller. And it took, you know, 3.5 years to capture everything we needed to capture, because people don't change overnight. You know, it's sort of a gradual process. Mm-hmm. So that's something that also just sort of became a reality in making this movie. It was definitely going to be a long-term project.
It's you know, you mentioned the way it was captured on film. It's actually a very beautiful film, and some of the scenes in Africa and in the mountains are just beautiful stuff. And of course, when you go into the Baltimore area, some of it's very gritty, as it has to be. So it's a very well filmed movie as well.
Thank you very much. I mean, we really tried to show the contrast between the two worlds, the parallel worlds, life back home in Baltimore and sort of the endless plains of East Africa. And it was sort of a metaphor for, you know, the openness that they experienced in Africa. And also, you know, just the color palettes, just on the more technical level, the color palettes of the two places somehow work beautifully together. I mean, Baltimore has a beautiful light. It sits somewhere. I don't know why it is. There's not really any tall buildings. And there's this golden light, which actually matched Africa. So it was sort of interesting to play with those color palettes of these two, you know, polar opposite places.
Hmm. Of course, Africa has all the wide open spaces. In Baltimore, you're looking at, you know, tenement housing. It's a little different type of exploration there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I just really was overwhelmed by the film. You know, I get a lot of movies here, and many of them are scheduled for interviews, and sometimes I'll watch the first 10 minutes of it. But this is a movie I really couldn't stop watching, and it's something that I think about after it's over. And I would hope that people who are watching this are inspired to do something.
Well, you know, people have been inspired. We get emails, we get letters. There's a scholarship program that's been started called the Baraka Youth Empowerment Fund that was started by some former Baraka school teachers who are actually working at Johns Hopkins. And if you go to our website, actually, lokifilms.com, there's a link to it. And there's a lot people can do. And what I tell people when they contact me or ask, oh, you know, how can I help? And the answer is, honestly, it's that one-on-one contact. It's that those Big Brother programs, those Big Sister programs. These kids, like Bill Cosby said in the extras, need a body on them. They need to know that somebody cares where they are, what they're doing, if they're doing their homework, what they're learning. That every child needs that knowledge and that comfort that there's an adult in their lives there's going to be some kind of guiding hand. And all of us can do that. All of us can do that in our own communities, and that's what I tell people. There's no quick fix here. It's about each and every person reaching out to people in their own communities, and I think that's a start, you know? That's definitely a start.
And for people who are living in communities like we are here in the suburbs where I am, where most of the kids here do get attention, although some don't, the thing I thought was very poignant was that the teachers at the Baraka school, for the most part, were white.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a flaw in the program. I mean, I think these kids really did need African-American male role models in their lives, you know, that were doing something with themselves. And I think, you know, I think that would have been helpful in the program. There was one African-American counselor, it was a woman, and the school said that they had tried to recruit African-American teachers and counselors, and they didn't have a lot of luck, but I think that they could have tried a bit harder, because they were hungry for male role models, and they gravitated towards a lot of the African teachers, the male teachers. But you know what? The school, nothing's perfect, and it's like, you know, at $5,000 a year, which was the salary the teachers were getting there, these people were extremely dedicated, young and dedicated teachers, and who still really keep up with the kids and have that they've maintained that relationship with those boys. And
see, I didn't think that the white teachers was a defect. I kind of agree with Bill Cosby, whose comment on that was, hey, you know, where are the African-American men stepping up? I didn't see any there.
That's definitely a problem.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the big problem. And the fact that in the urban areas, many of those areas, 70% of the families are with a woman and no man, that's a problem.
It's a big problem.
Bill Cosby has talked about it before and has been harassed about it because people
don't
want to hear
it. Very provocative, and I know he gets a lot of people, he makes a lot of people angry with some of the things that he says, but I feel like he's, you know, I think he's reflecting, he's fed up, you know, and frustrated, I think, with the African-American men that are not stepping up to the plate, and that's a total generalization, but he definitely has zeroed in on that problem, which is real and it's undeniable. And I think that that's part of the reason why he gravitated towards this film, because it was evident. It's another example of the disappearing, you know, African-American male role model, and these kids really needed that support. So I think it's one of the things that attracted him.
How did you go from the concept of coming up with this film to coming up with Loki Films to also, was it Lucky Films, I guess?
Loki,
yeah, I was right, okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, my eyesight's going with me. But coming from that and then getting into all the festivals, I know you won the NAACP Image Awards for Outstanding Independent Film. It's been all over the place now. How do you go from a concept to getting it all over the place?
Oh, it's so long and arduous, and you don't even realize you're doing it, but you just end up. I mean, this film, you know, we financed it ourselves for the first year and a half, and then PBS came in, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, God bless them, came in with finishing funds. We would have never been able to finish the movie and edit the film without them. They saw the merit in the film. But then you get to that, you get it finished, and you want to bring it to the public, and you want a theatrical release, and then you start down that road of trying to get the attention and compete for attention amidst all the other offerings that year. And last year was an extraordinarily competitive, amazing year for documentary films, and it was very hard to get attention. You had March of the Penguins, you had Mad Hot Ballroom, you had the Enron movie. I mean, it was like wonderful for the public, but a nightmare for the rest of us who were trying to be heard and be seen and get known and all of that. So what we decided to do was to take it out in the festival circuit and see if we couldn't pick up a distributor and get some attention on the festival circuit. And audiences reacted so strongly, and the film just started to win all these awards and jury prizes and audience awards. And I mean, there was definitely a swell of interest in the movie. But then the film distributors, the distributing companies who loved the movie, got worried because they kept, you know, they have to worry about their demographic and you know, and the bottom line. And they said, well, you know, Heidi, we love this movie, but the last time a film about African-American teenage boys did any money was Hoop Dreams, and that was over 10 years ago. And they couldn't get over that, and I realized that I'd never thought of this ever, that it was not going to be considered commercially viable. They were worried that this was going to be, you know, another inner-city movie, and people would think they'd seen it. And, of course, it's none of those things. It's absolutely, you know, it's a character-driven story, and you're in love with the kids, and you're rooting for these boys, and it doesn't matter what color they are or where they live. But, you know, it took some convincing. So we just decided to go to every damn festival on the planet Earth until someone recognized that the film was not going away, and the film continued. It won the Golden Hugo at Chicago, and it won at Silver Docks and Newport and all these big festivals. And eventually Think Film said, okay, all right, we get it. We're going to pick up the film and we're going to distribute it. And they brought it to like 65 theaters, and then we got the NAACP award, and it got shortlisted for the Oscar, although we didn't make the nomination. And so this sort of, you know, momentum just kept building and building. And then, of course, the DVD just came out a few days ago. So now I'm really happy because now it's like the film has a new life, you know. I mean, you know, only, you know, what, 50,000 people maybe saw it in the movie theater. And now, I mean, you know, everybody can see it. If it's Blockbuster or Netflix or Amazon, and it becomes, I think, more and more democratic as the process goes on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Festivals are sort of elite, small places that are hard to get to. And
what's
people
the
don't just
suggested
go to
retail
film
price
festivals.
On this?
Sorry?
What's the suggested price on this?
I think they're selling it on Amazon for $22.
Okay.
$22 or $23. But you can always rent it, of course. It's rentable everywhere, I think, Blockbuster.
Can they pick it up at LokiFilms.com?
You could go to LokiFilms.com, yeah.
Because then you keep most of the money, because that's your website.
Yeah, well, Amazon gives us a little tiny kickback, but we actually, we're still on the hole in this movie, But but that's okay, because this is, you know, we're so proud of this film, and we want everyone to see it, and it's really exciting to put it into the culture this way and get it inside the culture, and just the DVD is allowing us to do that for sure.
I'll tell you one thing that would be really interesting, and I'm sure you've already thought about it, 5 or 10 years down the road, doing a follow-up on all these kids.
We would love to do that. We definitely have part two in us, for sure. We're thinking a couple of years down the road. We're totally in touch with the kids. We talk to them all the time. In fact, Rachel is with Richard today. He's at Job Corps. He's dropped out of school and is happily engaged at in his studies at Job Corps and is learning how to be a correctional officer, which is ironic, but he is enjoying it very much. And Devon is doing great in school, and Montre's hanging in there in school. And the kids are you know, doing their best, and we are very much in touch with them. And we would love to do part two in a couple of years, and hopefully it'll be very happy stories.
What else is in you and Rachel working on anything there?
Well, actually, I don't know if you know this, but we just finished a new film called Jesus Camp about the Christian right, the evangelical Christian movement through the eyes of 10-year-old children who attend a summer camp. for born-again Christians in North Dakota. And the film won the special jury prize at the Tribeca Film Festival a few weeks ago, and we are in talks right now for nationwide theatrical distribution. So definitely look out for that. It's a completely different kind of movie. It's much more political.
You'll have to get your people to get in touch with my people and get us a copy of that.
Absolutely, I will. I will.
And we can follow up on that another time.
Yeah,
we can talk about that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So the movie is called The Boys of Baraka, and it's an amazing movie. In fact, there is a website, theboysofbaraka.com, or else you can go to lokifilms.com, either one of those, and get your stuff, get a copy of the movie. It's an amazing movie, folks, and I'll tell you something right now, it's not going to give you a lot of laughs. It's going to make you think, and that's a good thing. So go out and get it. And thank you so much for first of all, for doing the film, and second of all, for coming on the show, Heidi.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.